You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of April 2016, here on Monocle 24.
Why did Clinton versus Sanders get so rowdy? Why is Germany grovelling quite so abjectly to Recep Tayyip Erdogan? What might be the lasting effects of the Panama Papers leak? I'm Andrew Muller. This is Midori House. On today's show, Hillary and Bernie go round again.
We really feel confident about a candidate saying that she's going to bring change in America when she is so dependent on big money interests. I don't think so.
My guests Lisa Markwell and James Boyes will be discussing whether or not yet another debate between the Democratic rivals will have changed anyone's minds ahead of the New York primaries. We'll also be looking at the day's other big stories and crossing live to Monocle's Quality of Life conference in Vienna. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to the show. Welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Lisa Markwell, former editor of The Independent on Sunday, and James Boyes, the historian and author, most recently, of Hillary Rising. Welcome both. We will start tonight in New York, presently bracing itself for Tuesday's presidential primaries. The Republican contest looks a lock. Bookmakers are offering roughly the same odds on a Donald Trump victory as they are on the sun rising tomorrow. The Democratic vote may not be much closer. Hillary Clinton heavily favoured over Bernie Sanders. But it looks closer enough that last night's debate between the pair was spirited, verging on downright rumbustious. Let's hear some of it.
I stood up against the behaviors of the banks when I was a senator. I called them out on their mortgage behavior.
Secretary Clinton called them out. Oh, my goodness. They must have been really crushed by this. And was that before or after you received huge sums of money by giving speaking engagements behind them?
Why not just release the transcripts and put this whole issue to bed?
You know, let's set the same standard for everybody. When everybody does it, okay, I will do it. But let's set and expect the same standard on tax returns. Everybody does it, and then we move forward.
I don't want to get anybody very excited. They are very boring tax returns. No big money from the speeches, no major investments.
If we can raise it to 15 in New York or Los Angeles,
Secretary,
or Seattle,
the viewers,
let's do it.
If you're both screaming at each other, the viewers won't be able to hear either of you.
James, first of all, this was what, the fifth time this pair have gone round so far? What can they possibly have left to say to each other?
Oh, at least. Let's be honest about it. This was Bernie Sanders' request to have the debate. This wasn't something Hillary Clinton wanted to do at all. Bernie Sanders is very, very eager now to try and build upon the run of caucus successes that he's had over the last couple of weeks, and we must give him credit for that. But his problem now is that the whole season now moves to a whole range of primaries, which are organised on a very, very different basis than the caucuses have. They require organisation and a great ground game. That's what Hillary Clinton has. She's 17 points clear at the moment in New York, and is expected to win that state quite handily. She only needs to win New York, New Jersey, California, and Pennsylvania to get the required amount of delegates to win the nomination. So he's very much now howling at the moon. You can make an argument that this is all over except the shouting, of which there was an awful lot last night. And you heard Wolf Blitzer there trying desperately to try and bring some order to the chaos. The problem he's got now is all he can do is spoil Hillary Clinton's coronation and add more ammunition to the fuel that will be thrown at her by whoever the Republican nominee is in the autumn. And the best thing he could really do now is to say, look, I've had a good fight. I've tried to keep Hillary honest, but realistically, it now is too late. He cannot win the 70% of all the delegates moving forward that he would need to. So he should basically move over and give Hillary Clinton the ground and the space to start taking the battle to the Republicans.
We will come back to that point. Lisa, do you get the... Well, did you learn anything you didn't already know or couldn't have guessed from listening to Hillary Clinton once again suggesting that Bernie Sanders is inexperienced and that his policies are more wishful thinking than not, and once again Sanders suggesting that Clinton is in the pocket of Wall Street, is the establishment candidate, etc., etc.? Mm. We know the lines at this point, don't we?
Exactly. I mean, nobody learned anything new last night other than... you know, who can shout the loudest? And Bernie sounded like he was losing his voice. But as we actually, James and I were discussing just before we came on air, this is very much of interest for the media, for the broadcasters, for you know, those with other sorts of interest, to keep this sort of keep this debate in a broader sense alive, because it makes for great television. It's a long, long way to November, and people get bored very easily, as we know, with our own EU referendum. Unless there's something enticing about it, the general public are quite, you know, are very easily bored. And
God,
so
there's another 2 months of that, isn't there?
There is another two months. Yes, I hesitate to. But you know, this is very, very lively. I mean, it does make for fascinating viewing, whatever the actual what you learn, which is very little. But you know, there is something at the heart of this, which is who copes best under pressure, who of the two of them looks more stateswoman-like, you know, in these situations where they are being sort of poked and poked again over the same old issues. You know, the big money for banks. Is it about the emails? Is it about wanting to break up the banks and how bad that would be for America? You know, it's the same old stories, but it is revealing, I suppose, who is able to continue to put a sort of positive spin and a sort of dynamic moving forward every time they meet.
James, Sanders is banging on this idea of releasing transcripts of the speeches that Hillary Clinton gave to Wall Street. I mean, is he attempting there to cause a fuss about not very much? Because is there really, that there's not really much chance, is there, that these speeches will reveal the secret hidden agenda for the covert control of the world by a cabal of international finances? All they are going to confirm is that people are willing to pay completely incredible sums of money to hear things they could read for free anytime they like.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a ludicrous smokescreen, of which there are a number that have been thrown at the Clintons over the last 20, 25 years or so. This is just the latest in a long line of those. I mean, Bernie Sanders is in a very, very fortunate position. He's a bit like when Russell Brand goes on Question Time, and he can be the quirky, funny one, because at no point is he ever going to assume the mantle of leadership. You know, nobody expects him to get the nomination.
People said this about Donald Trump 6 months ago.
Yeah, and I would point out also, and we were discussing this before we came on air, that people who are worried about Donald Trump becoming president should look at the whole card-hold facts that American politics is about electoral college math. And when you look at the states that Obama won in 2012, you must ask, of those states that voted Democrat 4 years ago now, which could you realistically see Donald Trump clawing back into the Republican camp to deny Hillary Clinton what would be a 303 Electoral College victory, which would take her to the presidency? So Bernie Sanders really is continuing to howl at the moon. All it's doing is detracting from Hillary Clinton's ability to take this battle forward to the Republicans and start spending hard, cold cash taking the battle to the Republicans instead of fighting a rearguard action for what will eventually become her nomination as the Democratic Party candidate.
But Lisa, what do you think of James's earlier suggestion that it's past time that Bernie sort of stopped nipping at Hillary's heels and let her proceed to the Democratic nomination? Sanders still saying he will take this all the way to the convention. Should he?
Well, in a way, yes, I think he should, because not only does it make for a more interesting battle, but people should be held to account as far as it's possible to do so. You know, somebody needs to be the sort of adjutant. I mean, I think the closest parallel, it's interesting, with Sanders is actually our own Jeremy Corbyn, who is someone who isn't actually terribly effective as an opponent. I mean, obviously, they're in the same party, and in Britain, you know, it's him versus Cameron. But the whole sort of idea of this man of the people, somebody who's the real antithesis of Hillary, you know, got nothing to do with the banks, happily publishes tax return and all the rest of it, you know, questions about whether it was a good idea to back the Iraq war. That sort of adjutant is not a bad thing, and possibly will make the American public, the huge numbers of whom are minded to go out and vote. You know, it will sort of keep them interested. And he does represent a very different faction of Democrats to Hillary. So, you know, there is something to be, I think, just for interest, if nothing else. I mean, James, I'm sure, would have a point about, you know, whether it's actually detracting from the business of, I mean, I'm all for Hillary. I think, you know, it'd be amazing when she wins. A woman in the White House is incredible. But, you know, she shouldn't just be able to sort of glide in.
And I wouldn't disagree with that. But what I'd say at this point is that, as you were rightly saying in your introductory piece there, are we learning anything new? We're not. We know what Hillary's strengths and weaknesses are. Bernie Sanders cannot win this. Full stop. All he's doing is basically spoiling it for the Democrats. If he wants a Democratic president come the fall, and presumably he'd rather have that than a Republican, then at this point, you know, he's in the same position that Hillary Clinton was 8 years ago, which is he can continue to stay in the race and claw away and maybe win a state here or a state there. But because this is a proportional representational race now, even when Hillary loses, she still picks up substantial amounts of delegates. She needs 624 out of the almost 2,000 delegates still available to her to win. So this really becomes a moot point almost. Yes, we want to keep Hillary honest, but I think that Sanders has done that already, quite frankly. As far as I'm concerned, his task has been done. Now it should be a question of let's round the wagons and say, do we want a Democrat in the White House? If the answer is yes, then the best way to secure that is to allow her to start spending the money that she's raising to take the battle to the Republicans now and not keep fighting a fellow Democrat until, what, the middle of June some point. It becomes self-defeating, I think.
Just a final thought from you on this one, James. Sure. The vote is on Tuesday, of course. Mm-hmm. Hillary, a clear favourite to win it, but when you're fighting a guerrilla insurgency of any sort, as Bernie Sanders is, as the old maxim goes, you win by not losing. How big does she need to win for it to look emphatic? Because if Sanders even gives her a scare, it does dent her a little bit, doesn't it?
It does, but again, those mathematics I was talking about before about winning four states, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and Pennsylvania, all she needed to do, California and Pennsylvania, that was based upon her winning just a very, very slim majority of those delegates at stake. She will want to win New York, which she counts as one of her home states, it must be pointed out, and win so by a margin. The figures at the moment have her 17 points up. If she gets a double-digit figure, she should see that as knife safe, secure, solid victory, quite frankly.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at Turkey via Germany. It's not news that the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, tends towards the sensitive. Roughly 2,000 of his constituents are presently the subject of police investigation for having expressed disobliging opinions of him. Recently, however, Erdogan's umbrage has ranged across borders. Earlier this week, he demanded that proceedings be brought against German comedian Jan Böhmermann under an obscure German law which prohibits criticism of foreign heads of state. Today, incredibly, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has agreed that prosecutors may actually pursue this self-evidently ludicrous investigation. Lisa, is this, as people have suggested, the obvious sop to Erdogan to try and keep him on board over the immigration deal that it looks?
Well, it's certainly, that is, of course, the biggest issue behind this case and behind Merkel's decision, one assumes, is the refugees, because that is the hot topic and everybody is very trepidatious of Turkey's attitude to this. And so Erdogan being unprovoked, I suppose, is the best one might hope for, is certainly sensible. But for Merkel, you know, it's a sort of lose-lose situation, because if she had chosen not to give agreement for the court case to come, then it would have looked as if she was, you know, just being a bit of a patsy. But if she had not allowed Erdogan to bring this case against Böhmermann, then it would have looked as if she was, have I got that the right way around? But she possibly not. But freedom of speech is also very, very important in the EU. You know, not so long ago, you know, we were all talking about Charlie Hebdo.
Angela Merkel, not least among the people talking about Charlie
Hebdo. Well, quite. And so, you know, she has to look at how she's going to be perceived at home in Germany. Is she strong on allowing freedom of speech, or is she focusing more on the EU, on Germany's very, very vexed situation with refugees? And I think, you know, that has been obviously a huge part of the decision. And also, let's not forget that this sort of archaic clause which allows this to happen, which says that you must be the leader of the country in which the slight has been demonstrated, has to give agreement for the court case to come. That is about, or it could be very easily overturned. And so even though it won't be in time, Erdogan will get his day in court, and this person, Böhmermann, will get a huge fine, probably won't get a prison sentence. But this will be overturned and it won't ever happen again. So we're sort of seeing a sort of strange political dance. You know, it's an anomaly. It won't happen again.
Well, all of which is true, and Merkel has said that her government will look into repealing this somewhat bizarre law. But nonetheless, this at the very least, James, looks bad. A poll in Die Welt says that 80% of Germans are opposed to this deal. It will give obvious succour to the paranoid far right who will use it to further demonstrate that you just can't say anything about Muslims or Islam or anything, political correctness gone mad, etc. And it is an obviously, I realise at this point I'm starting to sound like a free speech headbanger, but that's because I am one. But it does it restricts the space in which people can think and which people can speak, because more pernicious than censorship is the self-censorship that will now actually follow. So my question, I guess, to you is, why not just call Erdogan's bluff? Why not just say to him, look, this is democracy, occasionally people are going to say nasty things about you, buy a helmet?
Well, it's one way of doing it. I think that what
this is why I've never run for public office.
No, and I would recommend it, having done so. What I would say is that as long as you've got legislation on the books like this, which goes back to at least what the 1870s, I guess, as long as it remains on the books, it remains there to be utilised. And we have here a situation in which there are a whole host of much larger questions with regards to Germany, its role in the EU, the whole future direction of Turkey, which Merkel is obviously trying to juggle here. And for whatever reason, she sees fit to be able to say, look, let's greenlight this. I don't think anybody expects, and this comes back to the earlier point, that this is going to go forward. I dare say that the TV presenter at the heart of this is going to probably, you know, clean up and see his ratings and popularity rise, because he'll be an advocate of free speech.
At the risk of tempting fate, he's also an advocate of free speech presently under police guard.
Right. Okay.
It's a mixed blessing, I think, this sort of attention.
A distinct possibility. I think Angela Merkel's trying to play it as straightforward as she possibly can. I'm sure she would rather this not happen and would go away. As long as you have these antiquated laws on the books, you know, they're there to be drawn upon and implemented at some point. The answer, obviously, is strike them down, potentially. But then, you know, where does that leave issues to do with free speech? We want free speech. We obviously also want to make sure that there is an ability to try to leverage what we can out of Turkey. And I think Merkel is basically trying to walk a very fine line and probably coming up failing as a result.
Just final thought on this one, Lisa, and just going back to your earlier point that if this nonsense does go ahead, it will either get tossed out of court or most likely Bomberman will get at, you know, a tap on the wrist, which in my view is a tap on the wrist too far. But if that happens, and this, even if you're just looking at it as the real politic version, which Merkel seems to be, or the real politic course, which Merkel seems to be negotiating, if Bomberman is not punished to Erdogan's satisfaction, whatever that may amount to, isn't Erdogan therefore politically obliged to throw an even bigger fit than he already has?
Yeah, I mean, he is certainly not a person to be easily passive. You know, he has a very thin skin. I think it's sort of universally acknowledged. It's also a case worth noting that, a point worth noting that there are several other countries that have a very similar, very arcane law to them. Italy, Poland, Switzerland, I think, something similar in Denmark, Norway, Spain. There are quite a few other places. So, you know, if he were minded to, and if anybody said anything, as you say, you know, one day it's a sort of satirical poem with foul language, and another day it might be actually quite a sort of mild-mannered cartoon. If he wants to call upon those countries and say, you can't say any of this about me, this could run and run and run, and I think that's very dangerous.
Well, let's take a quick look now at this week's fallout from last week's big story, which was, of course, the leaking of the Panama Papers, the more than 11 million documents from the law firm Mossack Fonseca. This has thus far forced one head of government from office and has embarrassed many, many more. Today, the EU's five biggest economies, the UK, Germany, France, Italy and Spain, have agreed a crackdown on tax havens, which will see further data sharing permitted between enforcement agencies. James, is this kin to the EU's five biggest economies getting together and agreeing to a crackdown on the stable door?
Oh, how beautifully put. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, this idea that, you know, Panama has obviously made a track record of being a tax haven, and many people around the world have benefited from it. And now all of a sudden, you know, the Sunshine Law is coming to fruition effectively. And we're seeing embarrassment by within Panama. But, you know, let's not kid ourselves. This is old news. I mean, you know, The Guardian's been reporting this idea that various politicians have had investment accounts, including David Cameron, for several years now. So a lot of what is coming out isn't particularly new. One wonders when the next tranche, the next round of material comes out. There has, of course, been a lack of Americans named in this so far to date. And we'll see what develops, I think, out of this story.
And Lisa, just finally, in terms of how this has played in the UK, what have you made of how David Cameron has handled it? There was the revelation that his father had established a series of offshore trusts, a story which was first broken about 4 years ago, which nobody really seemed to care about at the time. Do you get the impression Cameron has pretty much ridden this one out or not?
Well, he certainly, in the early days of it, was as a newspaper person, you know, he handled it appallingly badly. And for someone whose background
is surprisingly badly,
because his background is in PR. So you think if he can do anything, it is to deflect and to obfuscate and, you know, get around these things. And he did a rather poor job of it. And as a result, his approval ratings are below Jeremy Corbyn's, which is actually quite astonishing. But this... this goes back again, yet again, to the subject we all will be forced to talk about more and more, which is the EU referendum. Is he seen as a trustworthy, upstanding citizen in a broader scope across the EU? You know, there are question marks about that. And of course, the Leave UK, you know, Leave EU campaign are sort of rubbing their hands, and they will try to sort of keep the embers, you know, keep fanning the embers of this. But it does feel as if it's dying down a bit now.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up, we'll be live in Vienna at the Quality of Life Conference. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And as of right now, Monocle's Quality of Life Conference is underway in Vienna. I'm joined from there by Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, and editor Andrew Tuck. Tyler, what's occurring right now? Where are you and what can you see?
Well, it is rehearsal time, and good evening in London, Andrew. We have got a contingent of about 20 hardcore, familiar voices on Monocle 24. Of course, a lot of facilitators who make sure we get on air and stay on air as well. And then we have set dressers, and we have cushion fluffers, we have catering people, and all kinds of people. We're just missing the Lipitz honors in here. And I should say that we're in the Palais Fairchild, a wonderful structure, which was built by the Habsburgs originally. As one of the stock exchanges for the former empire.
And are we noticing anything about the attendees this year? I mean, obviously they are the same impeccably well-read, very well-dressed crowd you usually get at these things. But does it change year by year? Does the conference have a different flavour?
Well, it's year two. We've drawn delegates certainly from more countries. Probably last year it was in the mid 20s. I think, as of this afternoon when I did a count, we had about 33 different nations attending. No surprise because of proximity to, of course, one of the world's biggest economies. A lot of German attendees. I would say there is a very strong Middle European contingent, but still the single biggest nation attending is probably the U.S. Despite, of course, a couple of dropouts, corporations concerned about security, insurance issues, all of those things. Not terribly surprising. Andrew Tuck, of course, our editor, as mentioned, is also here. Andrew, you could sort of maybe give a measure of the mood as well, not just the streets beyond, I think, but also here.
I think the mood both here in the venue and in the city is one that's very interesting. This is a city that is kind of defying the odds. It still makes stuff. It's kind of coped with so many kind of political ructions over the last year. I must say there's also a mood of vertigo between you and me. We're perched on the highest kind of balcony you've ever seen, overlooking the Palais Fairchild. But I'm really excited about the next coming days because we have such an array of great speakers who have come here. We've been rehearsing all day. We've been looking at all the elements you need to make a great conference. And I'm really excited to see it kick off properly tonight.
An ongoing highlight of this year's conference will be the release of the new Monocle book, the How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, which is out now about on Gestalten. To what extent will the contents of that book be driving the discussions?
Well, of course, the book is indeed been overseen and authored by our Steve Bloomfield. So, Andrew, you can imagine there's going to be a significant land grab on stage towards the end of the day. I'd probably say a full 50% of the conference. There will be a section devoted specifically to nation building. And I think last year, what was interesting, we were very much focused on everything within the city limits. And it's not just tying into the book, because that depending on the federal structure or municipal structure of some countries, you can have a very top-down approach to how cities are governed across a great state. And of course, in many other places, you see a great degree of autonomy. So that will be a new component that we will bring into the mix. But I think it'll be quite separate from the book. I mean, we want our guests to, of course, explore the topic. But Steve's going to be there. He's going to be plugging copies.
Just looking at the running order of the Quality of Life Conference, I cannot help but notice that for this evening, you have a cocktail party scheduled, and then tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. you have a run scheduled. What kind of numbers are you anticipating for the latter event?
Well, I just doing it in order, I think it's going to be about maybe 200, 250 people at the cocktail party this evening. And then, of course, there's the run tomorrow morning as well. I have, along with Andrew, and Andrew doesn't know this yet, Mr. Miller, but we're having a sort of a pre-briefing session on retail with Schweitzer, who's one of our partners. But we've actually said that I think Andrew's name has actually sort of gone under. We've slipped it under the door of all delegates' rooms that Andrew's going to be running, doing and guiding the run at 7 a.m. How do you feel about that, Andrew?
I don't feel too bad. I've already promised Tom Reynolds, who has helped organise the conference, I'll be up at 6 o'clock to come and pre-check all the venues, make sure everything's in place. I don't mind a run. I got up this morning, actually, for a quick run.
Oh, did you? I missed that somehow.
Well, for those guests who survived the cocktail party and then the run, what events are coming up tomorrow in particular?
Tomorrow we do kick off, and so this is important for all of our listeners. We will be going on air bright and early from here. A full overview, of course, on monocle.com. But it is a series of sessions, Andrew, and we start on media, and it was something that we did last year as well. We just think that having a debate in your city, having a discussion, whether it is young upstart media, whether it is the traditional daily paper, is very important. We want to really explore, though, this idea of the narrative, this digital narrative that keeps coming back again and again, at a time when we know that more bookstores are opening, we know that we're seeing an upswing in paper, more trees are being cut down, hopefully in a sustainable fashion, and just alerting people to the fact that there is a different story which is going out there, and then we really go then through the entire urban experience. And as mentioned, we end on nation building, and just with Mr. Tuck sitting beside me as well. I mean, Andrew, I think as we've sort of gone through all of these sessions, and of course we haven't rehearsed them word for word, we want to make sure it's technically tight tomorrow as well. But I think it's interesting how we've sort of moved, I think, almost from what happens on the printing press floor to getting you all the way to what might happen in the state capitol building.
Yeah, I think it's an amazing final session, and we have a woman called Mira Awad, who's come from Israel. Unbelievably, she was actually somebody in Eurovision, but now is a campaigner about peace. We have somebody from Estonia who's been campaigning about how you run a digital government. We have Gianni Riotta, who was the head of one of Italy's biggest newspapers. He's also going to be here. I think it's going to be a really exciting final panel.
Tyler Brûlé and Andrew Tuck in Vienna at Monocle's Quality of Life Conference. Thank you both very much for joining us. And thanks also to my previous guests, Lisa Markwell and James Boyes. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Ilse Viveros and Charlie Young. Our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. There's more music next. 1900 Marcus Hippie is in with the menu, and we'll have more on the day's big stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at the same time London, 1800 London time, same location in London. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening. Have a great weekend.